One of the challenges, as we all know, is to getting physical results, is to get to physical masses, which we can't calculate directly. However, quite often the glass is either half full or half empty, and in fact, in this case, the fact that lattice QCD gives us the results of QCD over a wide range of masses is actually a bonus in many ways. It gives us ways to extend our understanding of QCD. It also, of course, provides challenges, and I'll talk about the challenges of extracting things like nucleon and delta masses, the rho mass, magnetic moments, and in particular, strangeness magnetic moment. In fact, in this case, I'll try to convince you that some things can be calculated very accurately by a mixture of lattice QCD and a little bit of manipulation. And in fact, in this case, we're way ahead of experiment, at least I believe we are. I also want to say some things a little bit speculative in that connecting both partially quenched QCD and full QCD, but also quenched QCD and full QCD. And I probably won't have time for this. Okay, this is our challenge. Some of our colleagues are spending billions of dollars to look for why this is 3. What fascinates us is that the sum 12 is not equal to 938. Some might think that's a big problem. Now, the solution, the problem of chiral extrapolation is very simply stated. The time to decrease the pion mass by about a factor of 2 scales like roughly the 7th power, so it takes 100 times longer. At the moment, depends, of course, what you're willing to accept, but accurate full QCD calculations with 2 flavors really limited to quark masses in this range at the moment, maybe pushing down on the lower edge. If you want to naively get to 5 MeV quark masses, I've taken that just as order of magnitude of a physical light quark masses, you'd need maybe 500 teraflops, and that's going to take SIDAC a year or 2. The problem with simply taking values of hadron parameters calculated at various masses and extrapolating to the physical value it comes from the fact that from the symmetries of QCD, we know there's a chiral symmetry, we know that chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken, and therefore all hadronic properties are non-analytic functions of the quark mass. So there aren't simple power series expansions, there's no simple chiral extrapolation. You need effective field theory. I wanted to insert this because people keep talking, this is an aside, but what I'm showing here are plots of the structure of something like a nucleon. It's actually a very simple little model going back to the 70s where the valence quarks sitting inside some sort of bag are actually, what are they called? Hedgehog, a mixture of up and down with spin up, spin down, what's it called? Sorry? I can't remember what it's called. Basically, each valence quark is a linear combination of up quark with spin down and down quark with spin up. It's hedgehog. It means you can solve the thing analytically. And here we've put boundary conditions roughly appropriate to some lattice. Don't look at the physical scale is meaningless along here, but this is a sort of bag boundary. And all I want to show you is really what matters as far as whether the lattice is big enough at a given pion mass is whether between the region where the valence quarks more or less end and you come to the lattice boundary, has the pion field had time to die off? That is, it's not m pi l large that's relevant. It's m pi times the distance between the edge of the confinement region and the edge of your lattice. Basically, what happens is wrong. If the pion field dies to 0 by the time you reach the bag boundary, you're fine. If you don't have time for that, then you mix in a component that grows with distance. That is, a component of the pion field that's not there in the real world, and that component, through the boundary nonlinear boundary conditions associated with chiral symmetry, modifies the structure of the core of the hadron, the valence structure. And so what you want in order to get accurate calculations of hadron properties is this condition, with this being about 0.8 or 1 Fermi, depending on, there's no rigorous number for that. But if you want an idea whether you're working on a large enough lattice, this is the condition, not m pi l equals 4. And you can convince yourself that your calculation is meaningful when it's very far from it if you ignore this. Of course it could. Of course it could. But it's brave to pretend that there is no problem by looking just at m pi l. Okay, so what's the formal chiral expansion of a nuclear mass? Well, I think everyone here probably knows this, but let me just remind you. If we expand in increasing powers of the pion mass, there's what we would call the mass in the chiral limit. And I'll only talk about SU2 chiral symmetry, because SU3 chiral symmetry stinks for baryons. It's a very poor approximation to expand about the SU3 chiral limit for baryons. So I will never do it. Everything I'm talking about is strange quark mass fixed at its at the right value, and we're expanding in light quark masses. The first term that's that appears, there's no term in m pi in full QCD. There is a term proportional to the quark mass, so this is analytic. First non-analytic term comes in there because of Gell-Mann-Oakes-Renner, that's m quark to the 3/2, so there's a square root branch point. The source of that is a nucleon emitting a pion coming back to be a nucleon. That coefficient's model independent, we know it, and any chiral extrapolation should preserve that. At higher order, there's a term in m pi to the 4th, or mq squared log mq, another branch point, this time logarithmic, and that's associated with the process n goes to delta pi. Again, the coefficient is known and model independent. The problem is, of course, we want to fit lattice data at, as a function of pion mass using an expansion of this kind, and then determine the coefficients C0, C2, C4, and C6, and any others we can actually determine with enough data, put in the model independent values here, and extrapolate to the physical mass. The problem is that's only useful if this series is convergent over the range where you're fitting data. So this is what first convinced us there was a problem. This is a mixture of UK QCD and CPPAX data for the nucleon mass. It's fit with a cubic polynomial taking into account this non-analytic behavior. Let me see, three parameter fit is the dash curve. It fits the data quite well. The difficulty comes when you actually look at the value of gamma that you get from that fit. The value of gamma that you get is minus 0.76. Everything's in GeV. M pi is in GeV, Mn's in GeV. Whereas the model independent value is minus 5.6. That is, it's wrong by a factor of 8. If you're getting this model independent chiral coefficient wrong by a factor of 8, you have to wonder how well do you have your chiral extrapolation under control. If you fix gamma at the model independent value, the best fit you can get to the data with that expansion is that one. Okay? It makes things a little bit silly. Nobody would really do that, but it gives you an idea of the problem. What I mean is that what enters there is GA and F pi. What it means is the series is not convergent. That is, you need more terms in the series. Okay? The gamma should be this, but you need m pi to the 4th, m pi to the 6th, and in fact I'll show you how many terms you need. The solid line is a fit I'll talk about in a minute. Doesn't really matter for this point of view. So what do I think the solution to this problem is? Well, the solution is basically, and I'm concerned primarily with baryons. I've worked mainly with baryons. I won't talk about the meson sector. To what extent what I say has relevance to the meson sector is an interesting question, and it would be fun to work that out. When we talk about baryons, there actually is another scale in the problem. It doesn't appear in any natural way in the sort of chiral perturbation theory that I just wrote up, which is dimensionally regulated. And that scale is basically the size of the hadron. When you emit a pion from a nucleon, high momentum pions are suppressed. Now, of course, in any decent effective field theory, the reason you use an effective field theory is that you don't know the physics beyond some scale. You're using an effective field theory, and in case of chiral perturbation theory, the natural cutoff is 4 pi f pi, or something like that about a GeV. The problem is that that term in m pi cubed actually comes from integrating all the way to infinite momentum. And when m pi becomes 1 GeV, m pi cubed is a big number. Okay? So the problem is, the problem in the convergence of that series is associated with integrating your field theory over loops, over momenta where the field theory is meaningless, over momenta where the pions are not the right degrees of freedom. On the other hand, if you think about the physics, the fact that the cluster of quarks which give the nucleon its quantum numbers have a size of order roughly a Fermi suppresses the emission and absorption of Goldstone bosons when their momenta is when the typical scale is greater than 400 or 500 MeV. Physics, if you want to turn it into physics, I hate to do that, but sometimes it helps, is that if the Pion-Compton wavelength is smaller than the source, it's meaningless to talk about emitting bosons. In that region, lattice QCD tells us that all hadron properties are smooth and slowly varying. The loops are suppressed like lambda over m pi to some power. That is, the right expansion is an expansion in lambda over m pi, not m pi to the n. If you expand an m pi to the n, you'll get a divergent series. And not quite often in physics, what you find is where one expansion fails, the reason is because the degrees of freedom are wrong, and what it looks like lattice QCD is telling us is that this new effective degree of freedom is something like a constituent quark, and hadrons look like constituent quarks to a good approximation when you're at mass scales greater than 50 to 60 MeV for the light quarks. Let me show you what I mean. This is old data for the delta, nucleon, and rho meson. If you just look at the slopes of the average of the nucleon and delta, and just look above this region, so out here, where the pion mass is bigger than about 400 to 500 MeV. In that region, these can all be fit essentially with straight lines. A straight line proportional to m pi squared. Over this range, however, m pi squared is, to a good approximation, proportional to m quark. And in a constituent quark model, as you change the current quark mass, you find that the constituent quark mass grows linearly with the current quark mass. That's certainly true in NJL, it's true in Schwinger-Dyson studies, it's probably true in nature. And in fact, if you compare the slopes of the average of the N and delta mass to the slope of the rho mass, you find they're in the ratio 3 to 2 in this region. So the problem is not understanding the data in this region. In this region, lattice QCD tells us this is basically constituent quarks. The problem is we want to get down to here. This is the physical pion mass. I'll show you a way of extrapolating, which is given by this curve and by this one. Note there's a point of inflection there when the delta becomes unstable. Nevertheless, we can extract the mass of the delta from that extrapolation. The rho mass, although there's a point of inflection here when the rho can decay to 2 pi, in fact, a straight line gives a pretty good answer for the rho meson. It's one of the ironies of life. The real issue there is not what about this curvature, which makes an enormous difference. Notice that there's more than 200 MeV difference between a straight line extrapolation and what I call a decent chiral extrapolation. But the question is, how model dependent is this curvature? And to what extent can we extract accurate numbers at the physical mass? So, from what I've said, an acceptable extrapolation procedure has to respect the non-analytic behavior in the low mass region with the correct coefficients. It's got to suppress the chiral behavior as inverse powers of m pi when m pi becomes large. And there's a way to do that. It's called finite range regularization. It's equivalent to dimensional regularized chiral perturbation theory when you take the regulator mass to infinity. But with a finite regulator mass, which physically you can think of as being related to the size of the hadron, it resums the series so that the series behaves this way at large values of m pi. So let me say that again. We want to evaluate these diagrams for the nucleon. This gives the leading non-analytic behavior, m pi cubed. This gives the next leading non-analytic behavior. These diagrams have to die like 1 over m pi squared. It's sort of obvious. There's a pion propagator here that goes like 1 over m pi squared. The only way to get a different answer is to screw this up. So what we want to use is an expansion which is analytic in the quark mass, plus these loops, in the case of the nucleon, this one and this one, evaluated as a function of pion mass with some regulator mass, lambda there, which is finite. So we evaluate the self-energies with a form factor, finite range regulator, with lambda roughly 1 over size of the hadron. If you do that for the nucleon, this is what you get. This is the best CP-PACS data I know of. The errors are about 0.33%. Let me add the proviso, I haven't worried about all going to infinity, and I haven't worried about the fact that there are small finite A errors because of finite A. So neither A goes to naught nor L goes to infinity limit have been taken with this data. So I don't expect to get the physical mass when I extrapolate. What I want to do is use this data to study the degree of model dependence in the extrapolation. Okay? Now, in fact, what you see here are four curves. That solid line is an extrapolation with four choices for how I cut off the momentum integrals. Gaussian, theta function, monopole, dipole form factor. You can't see the difference. There are actually four lines there. Okay? They give, in fact, those regulators give the same answer to less than 1% at the physical pion mass. The statistical error is indicated by the blue hatched area, and that corresponds to the fact that we're extrapolating such a long way, even though the data up here is very accurate. But the systematic error in the extrapolation is very small. Sorry to show tables, but I want to illustrate it. It's helpful to look at the numbers, I think. Suppose we take a monopole form factor at the pion nucleon vertex and pion delta vertex. Remember, I had an expansion of terms. This is A0, A2 m pi squared, A4 m pi to the fourth. Of course, these coefficients depend on how I regulate the theory. They're not physical quantities. And you notice they vary enormously when I go from one regulator to another. Actually, this one doesn't vary so much, and this one's pretty constant. Notice that these coefficients get smaller. This is certainly about 1/3 of the size of that. It's not as small as you'd like, but it's still pretty good. Ideally, what you would do, and in this case, you would test that you minimize the chi-squared and the fit to the data. I mean, there's no absolute way to determine it, right? One way would be to minimize this fourth order coefficient. What we did, in fact, was to make a fit to the data with four parameters and find the optimal value of lambda and round it to the nearest 100 MeV. Because if you vary the 0.8 by 20%, this number will change by less than 10 MeV. The final number will change by less than 10 MeV. Okay? These numbers depend on the choice of regulator, but I can take those self-energy integrals and expand them in powers of m pi and combine terms so that I get physical renormalized coefficients. So this is the nucleon mass in the chiral limit. This is the renormalized coefficient of m pi squared in the expansion. This is the renormalized coefficient of m pi to the fourth. And this is the physical nucleon mass, that is the nucleon mass at 0.02 GeV squared. What you'll notice is all four finite range regulators produce the same answer within 1 MeV. If you look at the physical expansion, this is the expansion that would correspond to an exact dimensionally regulated chiral perturbation expansion, the one I showed you before. Notice the coefficients grow very fast. The next term, would be minus 60, the coefficient of m pi to the 6th. The point is it's an extremely divergent series as a power series in m pi. The reason is you're trying to reproduce something that actually goes like 1 over m pi squared. And you're trying to do it with a series expansion. If, on the other hand, you resum the higher order terms by using the finite range regulator, you see the fourth order coefficient's quite small, a factor of 40 smaller than the renormalized coefficient. So it's very effectively resummed the series. Of course, the higher order coefficients are different for every one of these regulators. That doesn't matter. All that matters is the sum of them is small. This morning somebody asked about the convergence, so I added this at the last minute. This is just to show you what happens with these four finite range regulators if we work to leading non-analytic order. So we stop the expansion at m pi to the fourth, and we include just the end-to-end pi self-energy, and if we include the delta. So the numbers I showed you are next to leading order expansion. If we went just to leading non-analytic order, the variation would be a little more, but it's, notice the difference is at the level less than 1%. Once you regulate the integrals in this way, the convergence is very rapid. One thing of interest is, what is the power counting regime? That is, where can I throw away this business of finite range regularization? In a sense, this relates to your question of how important is the choice of lambda. Okay? So what I'm showing here is with a dipole form factor, the best fit for the data. And then we adjust lambda, so we evaluate the self-energy integrals with a different lambda, 0.5 GeV, 1.12. But we ensure that the coefficients C0, C2, and C4 are fixed to the value which gives this which this curve yields. Okay, so we're fixing the low order chiral coefficients, the analytic terms, to the what we believe in this case is the exact answer, and then seeing how important the higher order terms are. And so you see where these curves don't disagree is what you would call the power counting region. And so basically the power counting regime is pi on mass less than 200 MeV. If you're going to use simply power counting and rigorous, quote rigorous, because physically it's completely unrigorous, dimensionally regulated chiral perturbation theory to make your extrapolations, your lattice data better be inside this region. It's not very useful. Okay, I want to go back a bit because when we started doing this chiral extrapolation business, we actually started not with masses but with magnetic moments. And so this is really old lattice data for the magnetic moment of the proton. And what I'm showing here, the first thing we did was fit with an old model, a so-called cloudy bag model, which has quarks surrounded by a pion cloud in a way that restores chiral symmetry to the bag. It's an old model. And then we could artificially, we could fit to the lattice data, and the solid curve is the fit using the model. In order to model it, we had to know the quark mass, so we fixed the quark mass to be 6 MeV at the physical point, and then scaled it with m pi squared. And the solid line's the fit. The dashed line is what you get if you turn off the pion cloud and just get the bag contribution. So you see, basically, that as we go to large mass, the pion cloud becomes less and less important. As we get to light masses, the pion mass gets very important. Now that was a model. At the time, Derek Lineweber felt that no one in the lattice community would ever listen to a model calculation, and he was probably right. So we made a little fit, which looked somewhat more sophisticated than the model. I'll tell you what the fit is in a minute. This is the same thing for the neutron. Again, bag with pion cloud, bag without pion cloud, and fit. Now, what was the fit? Well, the idea of the fit was, at large pion mass, we expect that the nucleon looks like three constituent quarks whose masses scale like m pi squared. So we expect at large mass, the magnetic moment of the proton and the magnetic moment of its quarks will all go like 1 over m pi squared. We know that when m pi goes to naught, the magnetic moment behaves this way, with alpha again a model-independent coefficient given by chiral perturbation theory. Alpha is 4.4 nuclear magnetons per GeV. Incidentally, if you put in the physical pion mass, you'll notice this term is about 6/10 of a nuclear magneton. That is, it's a third of the neutron magnetic moment. Completely non-analytic, can only come from Goldstone boson loops. Any constituent quark model that ignores it is basically meaningless. So if you realize that this data can't determine very many parameters, the simplest thing to do is to take a part A approximate that has the correct behavior when m pi becomes large. Beta is a fit parameter. Alpha is fixed by chiral perturbation theory. The mu naught here is so that when I expand, I get this form. And mu naught is a fit parameter. So if you assume that this data can give you two parameters, you build in the correct chiral behavior when m pi goes to naught and the correct heavy quark limit, you can fit alpha, you can fit mu naught and beta, and you get the solid curves. And a lot of people looking at this would say you've got rocks in your head. Who's going to believe this curvature? But nevertheless, that's what you get when you build in those constraints. And when you read off the magnetic moments at the physical value, even with this old lousy data, you get quite reasonable magnetic moments, but with sizable errors. So that was the fit I showed you on the previous curve. What we wanted to do was check that a fit form of this kind could actually fit what we found in the model calculation, and then we threw away the model and said, analyze the data with this. Now, just as a matter of interest, given that no one in their right mind would believe this curvature, it's interesting to look at modern data, unfortunately quenched. I'm not aware of any unquenched calculation of form fact. Oh, no, that's not true, but the errors are large. What's fascinating is if you compare the magnetic moment of the proton and the delta plus, and remember, the old data basically started here and went up. Now there's data, this is with Flick fermions down to about 400 MeV pion mass. You perhaps, if you've got an imagination, start to see a rise here, but let's not worry about that. What really matters is the difference between the behavior of the delta and the proton. It's an interesting property of quenched QCD, sick as it is, that the coupling constant squared for the process delta to n pi is negative. That is, in quenched QCD, the transition delta to n pi has a negative coupling constant squared. And so the chiral correction for the delta actually has the opposite sign in quenched QCD. And you see that beautifully in this data. So although neither of the curves alone would be convincing, when you put the two together, you can start to see the chiral behavior that you expect in the quenched QCD data. I'll come back to this property later. If you take the fits to, this is some more recent data with Flick fermions and some QCDSF data for the proton magnetic moment, the solid curve is now a fit with, which is a little bit more modern, fit with an expansion just as we did for the nucleon mass in analytic terms in quark mass, plus the chiral loops evaluated with a finite range regulator. So this is a modern version of how we would fit this data. If we now take the chiral loops and expand them in powers of m pi to the n, you have to get to n equals 10 before you get to here. So this is m pi squared, m pi cubed, m pi to the fourth, m pi to the fifth, m pi to the sixth. You see, it's not a very convergent expansion. You have to go to m pi to the 26th before you get to the first data point. Okay? It's not an intelligent way to treat something that behaves like 1 over m pi to the fourth at large m pi. Okay, the propaganda is that I've told you, I've illustrated some of the problems with extracting physical numbers from lattice data. I've shown that in some cases where we know the chiral coefficients, in particular for the nucleon mass, we can extract The systematic area associated with the extrapolation is quite small. We still need data at smaller mass in order to reduce the statistical errors in the extrapolation. But actually, that data at large mass itself is useful. We know we've learned a lot from QCD by looking at its behavior as a function of the number of colors, even though we have three in the real world. But there's another axis where actually lattice QCD can give us a lot of help. Even though we want the number here, three colors and five MeV, lattice QCD gives us an enormous amount of data out in this region. And having that data, which is a rigorous consequence of QCD, non-perturbative QCD, adds an additional dimension to our knowledge, and it's something we can use when it comes to modeling hadron properties. So I want to take just a couple of minutes. I realize there's probably not a lot of people here interested in it, but I hope you'll go away with a message for some of your friends. It's traditional to make constituent quark models for light quarks and to emit the effect of pions, or to assume that the effects of pions are included in parameters, like the quark mass somehow mocks up the effect of the pion cloud. That isn't tenable. Pion loops shift the nucleon mass by of order 300 MeV and a similar amount for the delta. The leading non-analytic term in the magnetic moment, I've already told you, is about 0.6 nuclear magnetons, a third of the physical neutron magnetic moment. The leading non-analytic term in RP squared, it depends on what you take for the renormalization scale, it's a logarithm. But if you take 4 pi f pi, this number is 1 Fermi squared for the leading non-analytic term in the proton mean square radius at the physical pion mass. So these leading non-analytic terms can only come from Goldstone boson loops. You should calculate them. When principle, the NJL model also contains, it satisfies chiral symmetry. So there, if you calculate all of the consequences of the model, it will have pion loops with the correct coefficients. Sorry? That's an interesting comment. Probably the biggest mistake that's ever been made in dealing with chiral properties of quark models is to deal with coupling of pions to quarks, to write an effective Lagrangian at the level of pions coupling to quarks. Because the chiral behavior is determined by the mass of the baryon that accompanies the meson. Okay? It's a little bit technical. I'm aware of very few people who have actually calculated within models like NJL who've calculated the chiral corrections and got the right coefficients. It's not normal. When you see quark models with pion exchange, you'll usually see it written in the nuclear physics form, sum over I less than J Vij, where Vij is some effect, some static potential for pion exchange. It's a good approximation in nuclear physics because the nucleon mass is huge. It's a terrible approximation in hadronic physics because the quark mass is not so different from the pion mass. And recall is very important. Look, I can show in great detail if you want. But basically, you have to compute chiral corrections at the level of baryon emits meson, leaves baryon, or meson emits meson, leaves behind meson, not at the quark level. You have to know what the other quarks are doing in order to get the energy right. When a nucleon emits a pion, if it leaves behind a nucleon, the range is 1.4 Fermi, the range of the pion cloud. If it leaves behind a delta, the range is about half a Fermi, because it's the pion mass plus the n delta mass difference which determines the range. So in one case, the range is half a Fermi, in the other case, the range is 1.5 Fermis. And if you ignore the fact that in one case, you've got spin 1 pair left behind as a spectator pair, in the other case, you've got spin 0, you get completely the wrong behavior. I don't know whether that helped or it's too fast. No. It's a diversion. I just want to show you a little game. The idea is, go up into the region where we've already seen from lattice data that chiral corrections are very small, that the lattice data behaves like a constituent quark model. Make a model for magnetic moments of the baryon octet up there. So what we've done is, at the strange quark mass, plus or minus 20 MeV, calculate the magnetic moments of the proton, cascade, and sigmas and so on, but they're negative. They're on another plot. Calculate the magnetic moments up here, and then extrapolate using this Pade approximate I just showed you with the correct chiral behavior in each case to the physical limit. And in fact, what you find is you get a better description of the data from such a simple quark model, which basically says this is the place to build a constituent quark model, not here. I'll come back and reinforce that in a minute. I want to talk briefly about something I haven't talked about anywhere. This is new. It was Wes Armour's PhD thesis at Swansea, working with Chris Outon. And it's an analysis of CP PAX data on the Rho meson. And it's a collection of basically 80 sets of data corresponding to different combinations of beta, kappa C, and kappa valence. And let me just show you quickly. So this is a summary of the data included in the FIT. M unitary is the pion mass when basically the kappa C equals kappa valence. And so there are four different values of beta and four values of the mass. Of the quark mass for each of these cases. And of course, since this is partially quenched QCD, the lattice spacing depends a little on the C quark mass. At each there are actually four values of beta, five values of the C quark mass, and four values of the valence quark mass, so a total of 80 different sets of data. These are some of the contributions to the self-energies that you have to worry about. There's a contribution from a single eta primed loop where we have a valence quark line running around the outside and inside a C quark line. So, for example, if this represents rho to pi pi, the pion masses here correspond to one quark with kappa valence and the other with kappa C, and the same here. So the pion masses here correspond to a mixed valence content. We also have to sum up, of course, these bubble diagrams, which just involve kappa C. These lines involve kappa valence. There's a lot of bookkeeping to keep track of. Now, you asked before how you would determine this coefficient for finite range regularization. In the case of this data, the data is good enough. There's 80 sets of data. From which you can determine lambda by a best fit to the whole set of data. So what we've done in order to fit the data is take this actually shouldn't have degenerate on it. This is one case. This is the case where the two valence quark masses are the same, but the C quark mass is varying. You calculate the self energies corresponding to partially quenched QCD. Coefficients, the coupling constants are known reasonably well. You evaluate them using a finite range regulator with mass parameter lambda. The difference, for vector mesons, the self-energy naturally modifies the mass squared just because it's a boson propagator. So we take the square root in order to get the mass with the self-energy terms taken out and fit that with something analytic in the valence quark mass. So this is just like the expansion for the nucleon mass. This is a constant times the valence quark mass squared, valence quark mass to the third power. This data is good enough that one can also allow for the coefficient here to be dependent on the lattice spacing. It turns out that there's no significant improvement in the fit for allowing any of these to be dependent on the lattice spacing. So in fact, that's been ignored. But you see there's a very natural minimum in the chi-squared for lambda around 650 MeV in this case. So in this case, you can determine the best mass parameter. What you see here is the data. So there's 80 data points on here, which correspond to the raw data in blue. Now this data corresponds to different choices of beta, of kappa C and kappa valence. If you remove the A dependence from the best fit, you get the distribution of points shown in green. Notice the scatter's already removed a lot just by removing the order A squared errors. If you in addition remove the self-energies calculated using the finite range regulator, so we've now taken out both the order A squared and order A errors in the coefficient A naught and the self-energies, you get the red dot, the red points, which really lie on a straight line. The coefficients A4 and A6 are quite small. Let me show you that a different way. This is the scatter of the points around the best fit. The green does not have the self-energies removed, the red does. And in fact, it's a little hard to tell, but I think anyone used to looking at this sort of data will believe that the difference in chi-squared is a factor of 2 between the red and the green data. When you evaluate the physical mass with this fit using the chiral extrapolation, all of this data, so basically this fit plus the self-energies for rho to pi pi and rho to omega pi, which give the next to leading and leading non-analytic corrections, lead to a rho mass 779 with these errors. Naive chiral extrapolation gives something like 825. So the chi-squared's a factor of 2 better, and the agreement with the data is really nice. It's really quite a step forward, I think, in analyzing the data. This is the most extensive data set for mass of the rho that I know of, and it's a very nice description of the data. Okay, let me come back. That's all I'll say about mesons, because mainly we've concentrated on baryons. But I want to come back to the chiral expansion, but now I want to talk about quench QCD. Now, this is particularly interesting because of the discussion this morning of milk, because the data we analyzed here is actually milk data, and so it's fascinating to look at this. In quench QCD, we've got this problem that the eta primed is also a Goldstone boson. So when we expand the nucleon mass, we have a term coming from We call it DHP, but I'm now trying to... Double hairpin, thank you. We've got the double hairpin contribution, 2 pi on propagators. So this dies off like 1 over m pi to the fourth at large m pi, so it very quickly becomes small. But at small mass, it behaves like m pi. And so this is now the leading non-analytic behavior. At m pi cubed, we'd have 2 contributions now. There's the old one associated with n to n pi, but now the coefficients are different from full QCD because the couplings have changed. But in addition, we have a term coming from the single hairpin, from a contribution from the eta prime. So this coefficient C3 has 2 sources. What we did at this stage was just to fit the data with a less ambitious form, just the linear form in m pi squared, plus the self-energies evaluated in quench QCD, using the same value of lambda in quench QCD as in full QCD. And I want to illustrate what these contributions look like. It's interesting to look at them. This is the end, the solid curve is the self-energy contribution with this finite range regulator associated with the process n to n pi. So you see it's about 230 MeV at the physical pion mass, drops off to about 80 MeV at large pion mass, and eventually it goes to zero. The n to delta pi term is the dash curve. It's a similar size. It's just not as divergent down here because it goes like m pi to the fourth log m pi. This goes like m pi cubed. The term that all the fuss is made about in Quench QCD, namely the term that behaves like MPI, is this blue one. Because it falls off like 1 over MPI to the fourth, it actually is extremely small. And in any region where lattice data exists, very flat. You could pretty much ignore it, actually. But as a matter of principle, it's fascinating because it gives the leading non-analytic behavior. If you look at the end-to-end pi term in Quench QCD, that's the dash dot, it's smaller by about a factor of 4 because the pion-nucleon coupling constant in Quench QCD is reduced from what it is in full QCD. The end-to-delta pi coupling is also reduced, but not as much, so the dash curve becomes this one. And finally, there's the single hip in the eta prime term with a single loop. What's fascinating is the delta. Notice the delta, actually the term linear in MPI, is actually somewhat bigger. So this is the double hairpin from the eta prime, single hairpin from the eta prime. Actually, it would only be linear in MPI when... it's delta to eta primed delta. Right, so it's linear in MPI. But again, at large pion mass, it's very small and flat, but it rapidly rises in the physical region. The thing I really want you to notice is the thing I already pointed out in the case of the delta magnetic moment. The delta to NPI self-energy in full QCD is this. Point of inflection at the delta NPI threshold, but attractive, about 150 MeV in strength. In Quench QCD, it becomes this. That is, it's repulsive and opposite in sign, equal and opposite. It's the opposite sign, it becomes repulsive. And in fact, if you add up all the self-energy terms, the net self-energy for the delta in Quench QCD is actually slightly repulsive. Now let's look at the milk data, and this is somewhat old data. The analysis was done back in 2001. The data points from the MILK collaboration are the red or purple points along here. The fits are done by evaluating the self-energy integrals on the finite volume of the lattice used by the MILK collaboration. So the momentum integrals in the self-energies are replaced by sums over the momenta allowed on the lattice. The curves are the infinite volume limits, so you then replace those discrete sums by exact integrals. So the fits, the green points are the fits to each of the MILK data points for the nucleon in full QCD and the nucleon in Quench QCD, the delta in full QCD and the delta in Quench QCD. Okay? Green boxes are fits on the same grid as the lattice. Come on. The lines are the exact continuum results. The fit is done with the self-energies are completely determined by assuming that the F and D coefficients are the same in quenched in full QCD. So one knows all of the chiral couplings. The parameter that regulates the integrals, namely lambda, is the same. So the self-energies are completely determined. For each case, each of these lines, we fit two parameters, alpha and beta. And this shows the results of those fits. For the nucleon, in full QCD, alpha is 1.24. In Quench QCD, it's 1.23. The error is 2 in the last place. Beta is 0.92. The error is 5 in the last place, 8.5. The error is 8. Within the errors of the fit, these numbers are the same. For the delta, these two curves are fit by alpha is 1.43 and 1.45, and beta is 0.75 and 0.71. Again, within errors, you can't distinguish between these things. That is, this data can be understood entirely in terms of the difference in the self-energies associated with the leading and next-to-leading non-analytic behavior in quenched in full QCD, evaluated with a finite range regulator. Okay? Now, I find that to be a very dramatic thing. Notice that the delta, we have this famous result that's been quoted for years from CP PAX, which shows us that quenched and full QCD agree within 10%. In fact, the delta N splitting in quenched QCD is more like 400 to 500, is more like 500 MeV, in fact. In full QCD, it's like 300 MeV. It's not 10%, it's a factor of 2 when you look at the mass splitting between the delta and the nucleon. And that can be entirely understood in terms of the difference of these self-energies. So it suggests the following proposal for relating quenched and full QCD. If you set the lattice scale the way everyone likes to, that is using something which doesn't depend on chiral physics, and if you suppress the Goldstone loops, the fact that Goldstone loops are suppressed at large m pi suggests that the analytic terms you get from the fit, for example, coefficient of m pi to the naught, m pi squared, and m pi to the fourth, which represent the hadronic core, if you like, the bit that isn't the pion cloud, it suggests that those terms are the same in quenched and full QCD. If that's the case, if that conjecture is correct, you can correct quenched QCD results by replacing the leading and next to leading non-analytic behavior in the chiral loops by the corresponding terms in full QCD and extract physical masses. Quenched QCD is then not an uncontrolled approximation. So let me just show you what happens if you do that for the baryon octet. This is fits to quenched data using the same form for the cascade, the sigma, the lambda, and the nucleon. And then you replace the quenched self-energy integrals by the full QCD chiral loops, and you get the dashed curves, all of which agree embarrassingly well with the experimental data indicated by the stars. One interesting thing is that the chiral curvature for the nucleon, if we drew a straight line, you'd get a difference of something like 150, 200 MeV down here between the straight line extrapolation and the correct extrapolation. For the cascade, it's much smaller than that, which leads me to worry about this combination 3M cascade minus MN. Okay, so the last example I want to talk about is where we can actually do, we can take this idea and do something very precise, where there's a great interest in understanding what role strange quarks play in dense matter, and part of the way to understand that is to understand what role they play in normal hadrons. Is there a large hidden strangeness component in the proton? In fact, places like JLab, Bates, as long as it exists, and Mainz can actually tackle this with by measuring parity violation and extracting the strangeness content. For example, we can measure directly how much of the magnetic moment of the proton comes from strange quarks. The sample experiment from Bates a few years ago, 2003, gave a number that appears to be positive. This is with a factor of minus a third taken out for the charge of the strange quark. So this is nuclear magnetons. To get the physical number, you've got to multiply by minus a third. With fairly large errors. Notice the errors are 0.2, 0.26, 0.07. Now I want to show you that theory is ahead of experiment for a while, although the experimentalists are working hard to get better data. This is a lattice view of magnetic moments. It looks a little complicated, but it's not. What we want to measure is this loop with a strange quark running around it. Of course, there are infinitely many gluon lines and infinitely many other loops. I'm only drawing the places where the photon couples to either one of the valence quarks that defined our source or one of the C quark loops. The strangeness magnetic moment comes entirely from the coupling to an S quark in such a loop in lattice QCD. Using that those pictures, we can write the proton magnetic moment as 2/3 times the magnetic moment of the valence up quarks in the proton, minus 1/3 the valence down quarks, plus the C. For the neutron, using charge symmetry, that is, rotation by pi about the two axes in isospace, the proton becomes a neutron, the up quark in the proton becomes a down quark in the neutron, and so what changes is the charge. Similarly, the down quark in the proton is the same as an up quark in the neutron, which is why the charge there is plus 2/3, and the loop hasn't changed. So we can take linear combinations of these two things to eliminate either the down quark, so we multiply this by 2 and add them, then this cancels, and we get 2 times the proton magnetic moment plus the neutron magnetic moment is the magnetic moment of the valence up quark plus 3 times the loop. Or we can multiply this by 2 and add them, in which case we get rid of the up quark and get the down quark plus 3 times the loop. If you do the same for the sigmas, in fact the difference sigma plus minus sigma minus gets rid of the strange quarks altogether, the strange valence quarks in this case. And so the difference, and it also gets rid of the C, these loops. And so the difference between the physical sigma plus and sigma minus magnetic moments gives directly the up quark magnetic moment for a valence quark in the sigma. By taking combinations of these, for example, take this one and this, I can write one in the form sigma plus minus sigma minus over U sigma, and multiply this term by 1. Okay, so I've solved for ON, which is a third of this, minus UP times 1, and UP times 1 is UP over U sigma times this. This is a physical number we know from experiment. This is a physical number we know from experiment. The errors in these magnetic moments are very small. All we need to get the loop is this ratio. The ratio of the up quark magnetic moment in a proton to the up quark magnetic moment in a sigma. Constituent quark model would tell you that ratio is 1, so you already know ON. Alternatively, I can take this form, use the cascade to get the magnetic moment of an up quark in the neutron or a down quark in the proton, and write this form for the loop contribution, where we have different combinations of neutron and proton magnetic moment, and here the cascade magnetic moments. I've got two expressions for the same thing, this loop. If you put numbers in order to extract the strange quark magnetic moment, we need to know the ratio of the strange quark loop to a down quark loop, so let that be a parameter for the moment. If we know that, we put in the experimental values for these magnetic moments, we get two relations for GMS. If we set them equal, we get a linear relation between that ratio and that ratio. The question now is, can we calculate these ratios from lattice QCD? All right. These are calculations using Flick fermions of a lot of time actually on the supercomputer in Canberra, which is 1 teraflop machine. But unfortunately, the CSSM group can only get about a third of the time on it. So, but nevertheless, it's a lot of calculation. What you see is the magnetic moment of the up quark in the proton. A single up quark with charge plus 1 in case anyone's putting numbers in. Okay? And you see the errors increase as we get to lighter mass, but the lowest mass is about 350 MeV pion mass. That data has been fit with a form A0 plus A2 m pi squared plus A4 m pi to the fourth, so m quark squared, plus the chiral loops appropriate to a valence up quark in the proton. The blue is the fit on a finite volume. The purple is if we let the volume go to infinity. So, in other words, the fit here is with taking the discrete sum over the momenta allowed on the lattice. The purple is the infinite volume limit for quench QCD. We get the full QCD result by taking the chiral coefficients in quench QCD and replacing them by the chiral coefficients in full QCD. That gives the red curve. And the extrapolated value is the estimate by this technique of the up quark magnetic moment in the proton. Notice it's a little bit over 2 nuclear magnetons. In the sigma, we can do exactly the same thing. This is the calculation of the up quark magnetic moment in the sigma. On a finite volume, on an infinite volume is the purple line. The red is infinite volume full QCD. The extrapolated value is about 1.84, which you remember is somewhat lower than the value for the up quark magnetic moment in the proton. There's about a 10% difference. In other words, the magnetic moment of the valence up quark is not a universal quantity at the physical pion mass. On the other hand, if we look out here at large mass, that is basically when the light quarks had the mass of the strange quark, roughly, not quite, but roughly, we can read off the magnetic moment of the up quark. It's about 1.18 nuclear magnetons. And if we do the same thing for the up quark and the sigma, it's also about 1.18 nuclear magnetons. So out here, at large quark mass, the constituent quark model works well. Magnetic moments are universal. In here, they're violated by 10%. Let me just show you what's involved in that unquenching. These are the magnetic moments of the octet members that have negative magnetic moments. This is the neutron in finite volume quench QCD, infinite volume quench QCD, full QCD. The same for the sigma minus, for the cascade naught, cascade minus, lambda, and U in the cascade. Notice in all cases the agreement between the full QCD extrapolation and experiment is pretty good. If you want to know what happens when you go from leading non-analytic to next to leading non-analytic, this includes, the purple is the infinite volume full QCD extrapolation, but with just leading non-analytic. The purple includes both leading and next to leading. The only case where it really makes a difference is the minority quark, the up quark and the cascade naught. There it makes about a 10 to 15% difference going from leading to next to leading non-analytic. And finally, if we compare all of this, what you should compare is the full QCD extrapolation is blue with the experimental data in red. And you'll see that the reproduction of the magnetic moments of the octet and the magnetic moments of the individual valence quarks where we can extract them from experiment is extremely good. Now all that is so that you might believe me when I tell you that the ratio of the up quark magnetic moment in the proton to the sigma is 1.1 plus or minus 0.03. That defines a band across here. When we look at the up quark and the neutron to the up quark and the cascade, the minority valence quarks, the ratio differs by much more. It's 1.25 plus or minus 0.12. That defines a band up there. Where those two bands meet lies on that straight line I defined by using charge symmetry and the experimental magnetic moments, a linear relation between these two ratios. So the cross is where these two values extracted from lattice QCD intersect. It happens to be on that curve, on that constraint curve. That's highly non-trivial. Nothing in the analysis said it had to be there. Remember, universality would be over here. The red region is where GMS is positive. The blue region is where GMS is negative. And in fact, if we estimate the ratio of the S to D loops, we get a value for GMS, which is minus 0.05 plus or minus 0.19 nuclear magnetons. That's an extremely precise number. Okay? It's 2/100ths of a nuclear magneton. Of course, if you look at it in another way, it's a 40% error. But I prefer to look at it. And so far the experimentalists haven't noticed that, so they're impressed. It's plus or minus 0.02 nuclear magnetons. Compared with the current experimental measurements, which are plus or minus 0.2, plus or minus 0.2, plus or minus something, right? So theorists are way ahead at the moment. All right, so I had to show you that example. All right, I don't have time to tell you about, let me just show you this. If we can calculate how magnetic moments vary when quark masses change by a factor of 5 or 10, we can certainly do it when they change by one part in 1,000. And one of the fascinating things is that if the fine structure constant changes with time, so do quark masses. Quark masses change, magnetic moments change. If magnetic moments change, hyperfine structure in atoms change. And that you can measure to 1 part in 10 to the 15 over a year using modern techniques. So actually, we can work out how fine structure for atoms like cesium or rubidium depends on the quark mass. strange quark, light quark. These powers look small, but when you multiply by, you realize that quark masses change typically a factor of 10 to 100 more than the fine structure constant. You find that this corresponds under quite a well-known gut scenario to this ratio changing like alpha to the eighth. And at the moment, the limits on that's the change in the ratio of these two spectra is less than one part in 10 to the 15 per year if you take into account the error. That puts a limit on how much the fine structure constant can change under that scenario by less than one part in 10 to the 16. So one can take the things that we're learning by doing these studies of chiral extrapolation, testing them against whether they're right with experiment by looking at strange quark content of the proton, and you can use that to look at the weird possibility that there is physics beyond the standard model, extra dimensions whose size changes with time. I wanted to mention it, but that's all I can say. So let me come to the conclusions. Although I haven't explained it, the fact that we are now able to do lattice QCD in a region where chiral extrapolation can get us to physical quantities with reasonable accuracy and with increasing accuracy as time goes on, at the same time as we're able to do experiments which probe hadron structure very accurately, means we're at an exciting time for the strong interaction problem. Studies of hadron properties as a function of quark mass in lattice QCD is extremely valuable. It gives us understanding of how hadron structure works, where constituent quark models might work and where they won't. It can also be used to test for physics beyond the standard model. The inclusion of model-independent constraints of chiral perturbation in theory, in particular the correct chiral coefficients, is essential to get to the physical quark mass. Unfortunately, there is a convergence problem. That is the series, naive series associated with dimensionally regulated chiral perturbation theory. Alternatively, the power counting regime does not include lattice data. However, with the technique of finite range regularization, you can solve that problem. You can resum the higher terms in the series, and what's left is a convergent series expansion. That enables accurate controlled extrapolation of hadron masses, magnetic moments. I talked about the strange quark magnetic moment as well. I didn't talk about these, but I could have. Okay, that's it. Oh, and you wanted to see the picture of the collaborator. These are the people who've been involved in this work. Derek Leinweber from the beginning. In fact, we first started talking about this when he was in Seattle, long before he came to Adelaide. Wally Melnichuk is at Jefferson Lab. Stuart Wright's at Argonne. Ian Chloe's at Jefferson Lab from Adelaide. He's still a student. Ross Young's at JLab, and Will Detmold worked on the extrapolation of moments of structure functions. He's currently in Seattle. And I'll finish with a picture. Thank you. Of which?
Model-independent coefficients is the rationale at the beginning. You didn't actually mention the value of each of the
Okay.
So the model coefficients is about
error. Sorry. I'm not sure I understand what you mean. But let me... I did prepare something here. Where are we? Okay. How does the fit? Every fit I showed uses the model-independent coefficient. It's a constraint that's put in. And for example, for the coefficient of the integral that yields the m pi cubed term, looks like that. Coefficient chi pi is this. Where strictly these are ga and f pi in the chiral limit. Okay. Of course, you use the three-level values for those, but they're actually a very good approximation to the chiral limit. Variation's a few percent. And just as an example, If you evaluate this integral with a dipole regulator, you get this analytic form for the functional dependence on m pi. And if you expand it, that's the series expansion. And you can go to any order, but it's a divergent expansion, obviously. Yeah. Not from this term. You pick that up when you've got a mass difference in the denominator. I haven't given that here. I could show you that. Of course. The n to delta pi term has a logarithm. It also has a branch point at where the at the n to delta pi, there's no n to delta pi threshold, right? But when the pion mass is equal to the mass difference between the delta and the nucleon, there is a branch, square root branch point that opens up. It has zero residue at the beginning, but the residue is non-zero later on along that cut. So even for the nucleon, the process nucleon to delta pi has a branch cut. Even though it's not a physical threshold. But delta to n pi, there is a branch cut when m pi equals m delta minus mn, and that has a finite residue everywhere. And that's what puts the point of inflection into the extrapolation curve.
How far can you push this model? It is a model, of course, to put in the form factor. Could you have a Fermi relation or something in such a way that this lambda would not have to be fixed again when you do some other process?
Well, in fact, although the lambda that I've used, wherever we've actually been able to determine a value from the data, where the data's been good enough, it is the same. So, for example, we could analyze all of the quenched and full data for nucleon mass, delta and nucleon magnetic moments with the same mass parameter.
Right. So, I mean, that's sensible physically. Hmm. I'm wondering if you can make that sensible theoretically.
I think the sense theoretically is that you just vary lambda around the best value and see how much the uncertainty is. What doesn't make sense is to take lambda to infinity, because then you're including terms in the loop integrals which are outside the range of validity of the effective field theory. You can't say my field theory is restricted to a range of momenta and energies less than 4 pi f pi and then integrate over that momenta all the way to infinity, right? It's total nonsense.
It's only good for pi and not for zero, and that's the only thing there.
The main statement, the main philosophy was sort of similar. You believe less in this expansion that comes from the parallelogram, this general tendency. And there was an analysis that we were doing using this person and so forth. But yeah. I wonder, have you dealt with the chance?
Not for the pion. Yeah. We've looked for the nucleon, of course, in the same way.
But in that case, there is this body of work.
It's much more interesting for the nucleon, right? Because for the nucleon, the radius becomes infinite in the chiral limit.
Well, yeah, there's technical reasons that that analysis could be done also in a two-dimensional model, which is solved at infinite end and value.
Well, actually, there's a...
So there's a story why they did it that way, but I just... You're not...
Well, you've opened up to a different story, because there's a story for the chiral extrapolation of the charge radius of the nucleon. I mean, once again, there's a heavy limit, which is basically 1 over m pi squared, and a chiral limit, which is log m pi. That's exactly the same as the Schwinger model, where you have an exact solution for the action. And if you build, if you make exactly the same sort of approximation, namely two parameters, build in the chiral, there's no chiral symmetry, but build in the electron mass goes to zero limit with the right coefficient, build in the large electron mass limit, you in fact get agreement over the entire range with the exact action within a few percent. So you can show in that case that it's exactly soluble, but the series expansions are either divergent or asymptotic, that in fact doing the same thing works extremely well there. But for the pion, I have not looked at it.
Yeah, it just might connect to with this question in the sense that when Jackie was looking for the problem and saying that chiral perturbation theory isn't good, that he was looking for an alternative, he wrote a distortion relation. And I just wonder whether you can find your lambda in this.
Yeah, I'm sure we could, yeah.
Model, but it would do the same thing. Yeah,
that's possible. I'll give you an example where I've been extremely disappointed by that, right? I mean, the problem of nucleon form factors, which you can calculate on lattice QCD, but at quite large momentum transfer squares. Huh? The chiral extrapolation problem there is horrendous. There's no way of doing anything even remotely model independent. And one way we thought to tackle that was, say, using vector meson dominance, which is basically poor man's dispersion theory. What we found by doing that was that the vector meson dominance approach is so entirely dependent on very subtle tuning of parameters that it's absolutely useless as a method of chiral extrapolation. If anyone tells you they predicted anything based on vector meson dominance, don't believe them, because it's so horrendously dependent on just tuning your parameters that it's useless. That was very disappointing. We had hoped to do it that way.
Okay, well, I think that wraps it up. So.